Welcome back to the program. Earlier in the week, we spent some time talking about the ability to sequence our own genome and what it might mean for our own understanding of our health. Today, we're going to look further into the future at how cutting-edge genetic science will literally allow us to speed up and transform our own evolution. In a matter of just a few years, we may be able to improve ourselves and our children, duplicate ourselves, improve our genes, in short, to personally guide our own genetic destiny. However, this doesn't come without serious ethical, moral, and cultural choices. What was once the realm of science fiction must now be a real part of our national debate. We're going to talk about that debate today with my guest, Stephen Potter. He's a graduate of UCLA and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He was a postdoctoral research fellow at Harvard Medical School. He's currently a professor in the Department of Pediatrics at Children's Hospital Medical Center in Cincinnati and the author of a new book entitled Designer Genes, How the Forces of Natural Selection Are About to Be Replaced by the Forces of Human Selection. Stephen Potter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
When we talk about the ability to manipulate genes, the ability to control perhaps our own genetic destiny, how far into the future are we talking? How much of this is today? How much of it is way out into the future?
Great question. It's actually goes back into the past, at least a good 15 years, and it's just our ability to control our own genetic destiny is just going to gradually improve year by year as we go into the future. The first designer genes baby really was born about 15 years ago, and his name was Adam Nash, and he was actually selected as a very early embryo to be healthy, because both of his parents were known to be carriers of the Fanconi anemia gene, which can, if you get both of these genes from your parents, you have a devastating disease. And his parents had previously had a daughter named Molly who had Fanconi anemia. And the only way to save her was with a bone marrow transplant. And they couldn't find a good match. And so desperate, they decided what they would do is they would have another child and hope this child would be a good match that could save their daughter, Molly. But rather than just throw the dice and take a chance, they decided to genetically screen the embryos to make sure that not only they would be healthy, or it would be healthy, but that it would be a good bone marrow donor transplant to save Molly's life. And so this is positive selection for a trait associated with designer genes. And Adam was born and did save his daughter Molly, who is still now alive and living a very happy life. And so this isn't really something that's restricted to the future. It's something that's occurred in the past. But until now, we've had a fairly limited understanding of which genes do what. And so our ability to screen embryos and to choose four traits that we might choose or might desire, our ability has been very limited. But that's about to change now, because this book is really about a series of amazing revolutions going on in biology right now, and there are incredible consequences on medicine and even the future of our species. They're about the DNA revolution, the DNA sequencing revolution. I know you've spoken recently with Ken Davies about the $1,000 genome project, and that is going to just revolutionize our understanding of the relationship between specific DNA sequences and disease and health and other traits and characteristics of people. And I could go into more detail on that. But the book is also about the stem cell revolution, the genetic engineering revolution, and about how all of these revolutions are going to join together to change things very soon in terms of our ability to choose the genes of our children and how that will impact the evolution of the human species.
One of the things you talk about with respect to evolution is that traditionally evolution has been a very slow process, a slow, measured Darwinian process, that with the ability to manipulate genes, we have this ability, or we will have this ability, to make dramatic leaps in the evolutionary process. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, so if you look at the history of man, the making of man, it started 3 billion years ago when life first appeared here. 7 million years ago, there was a split between apes and the hominid or human lineage. You can look millions of years ago to see man-like species and Artie and Lucy. But so these progressions are measured in millions or at least hundreds of thousands of years from one stage to another in the evolution of man. You can see an example of accelerated evolution if you look at man-driven evolution of, for example, the dog. So the dog has evolved from the wolf. It's a domesticated wolf, and it started 10, 20,000 years ago. And if you look at dogs now, if you look at a Chihuahua or a Dachshund or any of the crazy hundreds of breeds of dogs that exist, some of them don't even remotely resemble a wolf. And this all happened very recently in evolutionary time, just in a few thousand years. In fact, hundreds of dog breeds have just been developed in the last couple of hundred years. And how did this happen? It wasn't with sophisticated genetic engineering technology. It was just very basic, old-fashioned technology, just a pick-of-the-litter approach, taking a litter of dogs and picking the pups that had the features that you most desired and breeding them further. And look how much, how fast we changed the wolf into the modern dog. And think what could happen if we applied these amazing new technologies of genetic engineering, stem cells, the knowledge gained from the DNA sequencing revolution. What if we applied these technologies to our own evolution in choosing our own genes and moving forward from now? We could do something so fast it would make the dog story look like a turtle compared to a hare. I think the possibilities now are pretty amazing.
Of course, when you talk to people about the manipulation of genes to cure disease, you generally find a receptive audience. When you talk about selecting genes and creating super athletes and jumping evolution, all these things, it does stir an interesting reaction in people. There's a fear that generally goes along with that. To what extent is that part of the thinking of scientists today that are working in these areas?
Oh, well, I mean, that's another outstanding question. And I think that in the first stages of this genetic manipulation of the human genome, we're going to be doing health-related issues. So, for as you say, right now, selecting against disease genes is pretty commonly accepted. You know, there's a prenatal genetic diagnosis of early embryos by removing a single cell from an 8-cell embryo, for example, chorionic villus sampling, amniocentesis. No one really has, well, at least most people don't have too much trouble with that. So now, as we sequence more people's DNA and we learn more about which genes contribute to disease and which genes contribute to long, healthy lives, we could just, in a gradual way, assimilate that knowledge into further selection schemes. For example, recently there was a paper in Nature where they sequenced the DNAs of about 1,000 people that lived to be 100 years, and they found they had some very common, interesting features in their DNA sequences. And then they could look at some other, a fresh batch of people, and just to sort of test what they'd learned, and they showed that, 77% of the time, I believe the number was, they could look at a person's DNA and determine if they were going to live to be 100 years. And so, if you think about it, wouldn't it be wonderful to give your children genes that would allow them a long, healthy life? These are good health genes. They're not just genes that avoid Tay-Sachs disease or Leishmaniasis or Huntington's. They're disease that nothing is guaranteed, but that would improve your chances for a long, healthy life. And let me point out that centenarians typically are incredibly healthy people that are disability-free well into their 90s. And so I think that there are going to be grades of acceptance in the population for different kinds of features. I could see how people would easily accept the notion, for example, of giving their kids good health genes. Now, what about cosmetic features? Would you like to give your kids genes that would make them very attractive looking? Obviously not health related. But think of all the money we spend on cosmetic surgery. I don't know. I could imagine that some parents would think this would be a great thing to give their kids again, a nice appearance. What about intelligence? I would say that there's a graded situation there as well, in the sense that we can now choose against genes that might give you a very extremely low intelligence in a child, that would be recognized as a disease condition. And why not then, once we understand the formula, why not be able to choose genes that would give our kids a high IQ? And then this is where we get into the evolutionary consequences, the sort of explosive effects. If we can pick genes that will give the next generation a higher intelligence, then they'll be in a better situation. They'll be able to even better choose genes for the following generation. And so on. You can see how this would self-accelerate. We do a good job now, they can do a better job in the next generation, and so on down the line. Think where that might lead. Also, in terms of athletics, I mean, I don't know if I would personally be that concerned about how athletic my kids might be, but if you've been to Little League games or soccer games for your kids,
right,
you've seen these screaming maniac parents. I recently just glanced at this autobiography of Andre Agassi. I mean, his dad was convinced to make him an athletic star from the age of 4 years of old. I mean, he had machines that were throwing 150-mile-an-hour tennis balls at this kid from a very early age, determined to make him a star. I mean, I can see parents that would do anything to have a Michael Jordan son, for example. So now, if that's good or not, that's something I think we all need to think about, and that's why we're trying to start this discussion, Jeff.
In a society in which we're still squeamish, at least a lot of people are, and there's a lot of pushback to the idea, in this country at least, of genetically modified food, it's hard to imagine people beginning to accept the reality of genetically modified human beings.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, James Watson said, to paraphrase him, that the genetically enhanced are going to rule the world. I think that as we move forward and it becomes apparent that we'll have the option of choosing great features in our children, the option of giving our kids great genes, I think there will be people that will be very anxious to take advantage of that technology. Will it be for everyone? I think obviously not. But I honestly, as long as it's used for positive effects, to give our kids genes that will ensure them a long and healthy life, to give our kids genes that might give them a higher IQ, if we use it for positive effects, I don't personally see the downside. I know there are some that say, well, we're interfering in the domain of God. There are religious objections. I'm not a very religious person, so I don't find them very convincing.
Right. Talk for a minute, though, about the economic side, not the religious side, but the economic side, the fact that as we are moving towards an environment in which genes get identified and patented and owned, are we looking at a landscape where only those that can afford it by virtue of either their own personal wealth or insurance or what have you are the ones that are going to be able to eliminate these diseases or have the good health genes that you talk about, et cetera?
Well, I think it'll be a lot like in vitro fertilization at first. It's going to be a situation where, your insurance isn't going to cover it. You're going to have to pay for it out of pocket. The wealthy will obviously have an easier time doing this. But, you know, I was just talking to Glenn McGee, a bioethicist, mm-hmm. on this subject a few days ago, and he was saying that in terms of in vitro fertilization, it's amazing what middle-class couples will do. They'll hawk their house, they'll borrow a fortune to have a kid. And I think that if in time the choice becomes between having an average kid and a genetically enhanced kid, you might be surprised at how many people would try and find the money to be able to do it. But there are definitely some interesting possibilities to consider here. Will we develop a genetic caste system? Will the rich have genetically enhanced kids who will then have huge genetic advantages over the rest of us, while the poor and middle class, as a rule, aren't able to do this? And then in the subsequent generation, will a sort of we'll develop almost a multi-genetic capability system where some people will just be off the charts in terms of their genetic endowment, and other people will be where we are today, which may not look so good in the future. So it's very interesting to think about where this might go.
Talk a little bit about the role environment plays, and that if you take two people and make the same genetic combinations or the same enhancements, that environment and the way those genes get expressed in the context of environment may also play a role.
Well, genes aren't everything, so we have to start there. But genes are important. So there have been a huge number of studies where people have looked at the genetic contribution, nature versus nurture. One of the most famous studies is a Minnesota twin study, where they look at twins that were raised in separate environments. So they were adopted out at an early age and raised by different families, sometimes under extremely different circumstances. There was one case where, back in the 40s, one twin was raised in Nazi Germany as a Hitler youth, and another was raised in Israel. And then they looked at these twins, as they were adults, and tried to determine how similar they were. And they found just incredible similarities. Of course, your appearance is very much determined by your genes. You take identical twins and raise them separately, they still look the same. But in addition, things like IQ, they found had about a 70 or so percent genetic contribution. Quirky things, religiosity, how religious are you? There seemed to be a genetic contribution to that. Obviously, if you're raised in one family, you'll belong to one religion, another family, another. But if you will be religious or not, there actually is a genetic component to that sort of decision. So it's not everything. I mean, there's environment, there's chance. There are molecular stochastic events during development that can be very important. There's this huge field of epigenetics, not just your DNA sequence, but the way the histones and DNA methylation patterns influence the expression of your DNA sequence. So it's not all DNA, but clearly DNA is important, your genes are important, and if you have good genes, that's a huge advantage.
What about there being enough combinations of genetic material that even in the process of enhancement, there is enough variety?
This is again a very interesting question. But think about the wolf. I mean, you would think that if you just kept breeding more wolves, you would just get more wolves. I mean, this is actually what Darwin thought. So he thought dogs had to have multiple sources of genetic information to get their incredible diversity. But now that we've sequenced the DNAs of dogs, we see that they all come from the wolf. So even starting with one thing, the wolf, and appreciating that not every wolf has the same DNA sequence as another. Different individuals have about 3 million base differences in their sequence out of the 3 billion present. There's a huge amount of diversity there. And besides, with current genetic engineering technology, you're not restricted to what's there. I mean, in theory, you could introduce whole new genes that were never there before. You could accomplish amazing changes if you wanted to. And this business about, you mentioned patenting genes, I don't really see that as an issue. I mean, you're not going to not be able to change one base in your gene from a A to a T because there's some patent on that. That sort of thing, that's not happening. That's not out there. That's not true.
Talk a little bit about what might happen down the road. What do we know scientifically if we have people with modified genetic makeup that breed amongst themselves? What transpires then? What are the dangers, if any, then?
Well, interesting. I don't see a problem. I mean, some people say, well, gee, what you're talking about here is it's going to create all the kinds of health problems that you have in dogs, which are highly inbred. But we're not talking about inbreeding people in the future. We're just talking about tweaking their genes. So I don't see us as creating through this technology a host of issues that might result from inbreeding kinds of things.
But isn't one of the areas that we're talking about a kind of, in some cases, a kind of prenatal genetic manipulation?
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. But, I I mean, it will be based on the knowledge that we gain from the sequencing of the DNAs of millions of people and associating those DNA sequences with the traits that they carry. So as sequencing gets cheaper and cheaper, you know, it used to be billions of dollars, then millions, now thousands, and it's going to be hundreds probably within a few years, we're going to go from having sequenced one genome 10 years ago to 5 or 10 a year ago to 1,000 today to millions in the fairly near future. And so all of this genetic modification will be based on the extensive knowledge that we'll gain from comparing all these DNA sequences from all these different people. And so, of course, you know, we'll have to be careful about it. And, you know, there may be cases where we could go astray, where we'd see that genes present in two copies create a disease, but we might miss the fact that that same gene present in one copy would actually be beneficial. I mentioned the sickle cell gene in the book, and there might be many more that we're not aware of. So, I mean, it's a dangerous road ahead. There are absolutely no questions about this. I don't want to make it out to be some easy road to heaven here. And there are horrible consequences that could come of it. I mean, the brave new world possibilities absolutely abound. So I think there needs to be regulation. I think the government needs to get involved. Probably the sooner the better.
And where do those regulations need to be? Well, in other words, will the science move ahead of the debate and the discussion about it, or will the discussion about it slow down the science?
Another good question. Well, I think that it's difficult to come up with a clean answer to that. There certainly have been cases in the history of science where the discussion has definitely slowed it down. When recombinant DNA came out, we had a moratorium on DNA recombineering experiments for a few years. This was way back in the 70s. It could be that when the possible impact of this technology hits the public, when it hits their consciousness, then the discussion will cause a slowdown of the technology. And that might be good. I mean, you know, maybe it needs to be stopped for a while we think about it. I'm not so sure that we need to rush ahead immediately. But I think that in time, when it becomes apparent that as we understand things really well, and when it becomes apparent that we can actually accomplish some good with this, like a longer, healthier life, that it will be accepted and that it will be implemented.
Dr. Stephen Potter. The book is Designer Genes, How the Forces of Natural Selection Are About to Be Replaced by the Forces of Human Selection. Stephen, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks, Jeff, for having me on your show. Appreciate it.
Thank you.